We're going to study about the humanity of Jesus. And you might turn to Hebrews chapter 2. We were there this morning. We did the first part of it. We're going to look at some things that are found in the second part of Hebrews chapter 2. Now, there have been several lessons before this. There have been four that have discussed the deity of Christ. And we're going to be studying the humanity of Christ tonight. Now, studying the deity of Christ does not eliminate the humanity of Christ, and neither does studying about the humanity of Christ eliminate the deity of Christ. And it's kind of hard to be saying equal amounts, or I don't know. I don't know sometimes what some people expect. I haven't known that for 20-some years on this subject. But nevertheless, our two previous studies have really centered in the book of Hebrews, and so does this one. Because this one also, in the book of Hebrews, has a lot to say about the humanity of Christ. And I think the most that's said in the book of Hebrews is right here in chapter 2, verses 5 through 18. Chapter 1 deals a great bit, and we looked at this in a lesson. It deals a great bit discussing the deity of Christ. And then chapter 2, the majority of it, discusses about the humanity of Christ. So, we'll be looking at some things in verses 5 through 18. I'm not going to read them all, but we'll pick out the things to look at as we go. And the very first thing, which is a basic thing, is found in Hebrews chapter... Let me read this, Hebrews chapter 2, verse 14. We'll read that one. That's kind of our central text. It says, "Inasmuch then, as the children have partaken of flesh and blood, he," that would be Jesus, "he himself, likewise, shared in the same, that through death he might destroy him who had the power of death, that is, the devil." Talk about this some next week, but this passage is really key to the whole thing. It tells you that he was likewise flesh and blood, and that in this, it is through death that he was able to destroy the power of the devil. Jesus came here in flesh and blood in order to die. Prior to this, being with the Father in the form of spirit, he could not die. Spirits being what spirits are, they're not flesh and blood. And also, we would understand that God was eternal. And if we know anything about Jesus, in John chapter 1, in the beginning was the Word, that was Jesus. He was in the beginning. He was eternal as well, is what these passages are telling us. And so, in order to die for mankind, he had to become flesh and blood. And real flesh and blood. Not some kind of a hoax or a number of other things that at one time or another, and even up till today, are said about him. I think that one of the things that sounds good but actually isn't true, people will say he assumed a body of flesh. He didn't assume it. He actually became it. So while that sounds good and sounds like, you know, a fine statement to make, it's not entirely accurate. And I don't think people are trying to prove anything when saying that. Some might be, but most people, it's just a poor choice of words. But the first thing I'd like for us to look at is man's exalted opinion. Man. Now, Jesus partook of humanity, so he partakes of the exalted position as well. And that's stated for us in Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 8, where it says, "You have put all things in subjection under his feet, for in that he put all things in subjection under him, he left nothing that is not put under him, but now we do not yet see all things put under him." Now sometimes we wonder, well, now who is that speaking of there? And it would be very easy to say, well, that's speaking about Jesus, but really it's not. This is said about mankind. And on the way, by the way of contrast then, in verse 9, but we see Jesus in contrast to this. And he was made a little lower than the angels for the suffering of death, crowned with glory and honor, etc. So you see man's exalted position stated there in Hebrews chapter 2, verse 8. And by the way, the bulk of verses 6 through 8, that's a statement that's found in Psalms chapter 8 and verse 6. Now, God's original intention was for man to have complete dominion. That was the idea. And it's not at all presumptuous to say that God created man with the capability to forego sin and have that kind of dominion. But such wasn't realized because of man being subject to death. And why is man subject to death? Well, man's subject to death because sin came. And that's what we're told in Romans chapter 5 and verse 12. Now, I think this sometimes is a passage that's misused. In Romans chapter 5 verse 12, therefore, just as through one man, sin entered the world and death through sin, and thus death spread to all men because all sinned. Now, that's sometimes used to promote total depravity. Well, it's not talking about this idea of total depravity. It's telling you how death came about. Death came about because of sin. And since that particular time, death has visited all men. Not sin, death has visited all men. And that's happened because of the sin that was committed in the very beginning. But Jesus came in the form of man in order to accomplish dominion over death for man. And so you have Hebrews chapter 2, verse 9, which we looked at just a moment ago. And I always try to point out, well, he's made a little lower than the angels. You know, just stop and think, what would that be? Well, let's see, there would be God. Then there'd be the angels. And then you get down into the lower than angels. Well, that would be down here in this world where we live. And you think about all the things in the world. Think about all of them you want to think about. You think about animate and inanimate objects. You can think of things like man. You can think of animals. You can think of reptiles, birds. Think of everything that's animate. And then you can think of inanimate things, trees, rocks, other things like that. Now, which of these did Jesus become like? See? Well, not birds and fish and reptiles and animals, and not rocks and trees. Well, he became like man, didn't he? So when he was made lower, he was made lower in the form of man, as it says. As it says there, and he did this so that he could be crowned with glory and honor, having tasted death for everyone. In verse 10, it was fitting for him, by whom are all things, and by whom are all things, in bringing many sons to glory, to make the author of their salvation perfect through sufferings. And once again, that's Jesus. So all this has been accomplished by Jesus in his humanity. Part of the reason why he came. Another thing we see is in verse 11, where Jesus is described as the brother of man. For both he who sanctifies and those who are being sanctified are all of one, for which reason he is not ashamed to call them brethren. I know back several years ago when the controversy was just overwhelming any number of people, Brother Mike Willis wrote a series of articles in Truth Magazine. I thought they were great. And he said some things that I thought were, you know, accurate. Although I soon found out that it was accurate for him to say that. But if I said the same thing, it was high crimes and misdemeanors. Anyway. But I like one quote that he had. This is 1983. It's that Jesus actually became a man. And he goes on. That's not the only thing he said. Any doctrine which minimizes or detracts from the humanity of Jesus is not the doctrine of Christ. He was fully human. I agreed with that when it was written, and I still agree with it 34 years later, something along that line. And I also want to add that there are some passages, and we are going to look at these now, over in 1 John and in 2 John on the subject. In John's day, there was a heresy rising up that was saying that Jesus did not come in the flesh. The idea was that he was born, and Jesus was human, not deity and just human. And at his baptism, that's when deity descended on him. And so then he was deity in the form of man for all this time until he was crucified. And right before death, the divinity left him and he died as a man. And this was part of a heresy called Gnosticism. It picked up speed after the death of the apostles. And it kind of progressed, as most of these things do, into other kinds of things and so on. But the main tenet of Gnosticism was denying that God became man. And they used words like assumed or seemed to be or appeared to be and other things like that. They would use every word possible, but they didn't want to say that he actually became man. Flesh and blood. And of course, John wrote his gospel to prove that Jesus is the Son of God, God in the flesh. Says it right at the very beginning of the gospel account. And then he wrote the letters of 1 John, 2 John, both of those, about this same issue. How much of it he headed off, I don't know. But I know that he dealt with these things and that they continued. And the thing is, the interesting thing about this is this doctrine continued till sometime about the late 2nd century or early 3rd century, when the whole thing just collapsed on itself. It's almost like this AD 70 business, you know. That goes out here so far, and you finally get out here so far, and then you're left with this, well, what's the point? If everything happened in AD 70, what's the point of anything today? And it all collapses on itself. And that's what happened with this. None of it, you see, none of it was real. Anything that happened with none of it was real. And so after a while, you know, you're sitting here and you're studying all these things, and then, wait a minute, there's none of this that's real. And then you know what's next? Why bother? So it collapsed on itself. 1 John, we've got up there verse 4. Or chapter 4, excuse me, chapter 4. Verses 2 and 3. By this you know the Spirit of God. Every spirit that confesses that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh is of God. And then get ready, because in verse 3 he's going to talk about the other side of the coin. Every spirit that does not confess that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh is not of God. Now what's this? And this is the spirit of the Antichrist, which you have heard was coming and is now already in the world. Boy, I'm telling you, that Antichrist, he gets around. You listen to people, and they will. If you mention Antichrist, you know the first thing they do, they run off to the book of Revelation. And they're over there, and they'll tell you that there's Antichrist. And the amazing thing is, you know how many times the Antichrist is mentioned in the book of Revelation? Not one time. There's lots of other characters in there, false prophet, but and others, but there's no Antichrist there. And when you began to talk about the Antichrist, wouldn't you go to the person who actually wrote about the Antichrist and look at what he did actually write about the Antichrist? I would do that. And you know what? You would think that the person that wrote so much on this, which by the way is the Apostle John, and you would think to yourself, well, did he define the Antichrist? And the answer is, yeah, right here. 1 John 4, verses 2 and 3. The spirit of the Antichrist, that's the one that confesses that Jesus Christ, that does not confess that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh. That person's not of God. He's talking about this business of the Gnosticism that was developing in his time and proving to be such a problem. There's your Antichrist for you. But you're never going to hear the Antichrist associated with the very doctrine that sprung up the usage of the terminology. 2 John, verse 7. Many deceivers, that's plural, say deceivers, plural, have come out into the world who do not confess that Jesus Christ is coming in the flesh. This is a deceiver and an antichrist. There's a spirit of antichrist. There's deceivers. There's many of them. So the antichrist isn't some super big bad guy, as he's painted out by so many denominational people to sensationalize the whole thing. Oh, the Antichrist hasn't come yet. He's going to come, you know, when Jesus returns, and they go through this whole litany of things and they tell you all about it, and they're trying to scare everybody out of their mind thinking the Antichrist is going to come. Going to become some great world power and where does all of that come from? Well, someone's fertile imagination. John seemed to think that the Antichrist existed in his day. That kind of shoots a big hole through the theory that you hear put forth so much today. But nevertheless, Jesus being the brother of man, like man, and that can only be accomplished through his humanity. Now the third thing we want to look at, back there in Hebrews chapter 2 again, you turn back there, we want to take a look at, we'll look at verses 14 and 15. Jesus became a part of humanity in order to deliver humanity from death. We've already said something about this just a few moments ago, but here's the passages. Inasmuch then as the children have partaken of flesh and blood, he himself likewise shared in the same, that through death he might destroy him who had the power of death, that is, the devil, and release those who through fear of death were all their lifetime subject to bondage. So you see verse 14, which explains why and how this has all happened, and gives you a reason for it in 14 and 15. And then by dying on the cross, Jesus has delivered us from the fear of death. Look at Hebrews chapter 5. Just a couple chapters forward, and verses 7 through 9. It says, speaking of Jesus, who in the days of his flesh, when he had offered up prayers and supplications with vehement cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death, and was heard because of his godly fear. Though he was a son, yet he learned obedience by the things which he suffered. And having been perfected, having finished things, you know, one of the things Jesus said on the cross, it is finished. I have done what I was sent here to do. And that's what the perfected means there, completed. And having been perfected, he became the author of eternal salvation to all who obey him. Dying on the cross, he becomes the author of eternal salvation to all who obey him. I've oftentimes looked at Hebrews chapter 5, verse 9, and I've mused on this to the extent that now, if he's the author of eternal salvation to all those who obey him, what is he to those who do not obey him?
Well, he's not the author of eternal salvation because they've chosen not to obey him. Now, he may still have eternal salvation available, but those folks who won't obey him, they can't partake of this unless they're willing to do what the author of eternal salvation says needs to be done, that they would obey him. And once again, this being a part of humanity to deliver humanity, well, that's accomplished through his humanity in that he came here to die. Now, another one is that Jesus knows what it means to suffer. And you find this, Hebrews chapter 2, verse 18. For in that he himself has suffered, being tempted, he is able to aid those who are tempted. Well, we know that, and I think we know the passage there in Hebrews chapter 4, verse 15. We do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, was in all points tempted as we are, yet without sin. And then once again, those passages in Hebrews chapter 5 we read just a moment ago. Now, the one in there in Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 15, a high priest, we don't have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses. In other words, we have a high priest who can sympathize with our weaknesses. The high priests were removed from everything. You know, they're above. They don't, you know, they're... I don't know. I kind of think to myself, the high priest, you know, they would know, you know, who was going to be the high priest. They'd know this, right? Because the high priest was passed on through the happenstance of birth. That's how you became the high priest. You were the son of the high priest. And when the high priest died, you became the high priest. Now, what do you think it was like being the son of a high priest? What kind of life do you think that you would live? You think we might say that it would be a little select. It'd be a little choice, perhaps. Yeah, you know, I think about royalty. I think about, you know, English royalty, and here's a couple, you know, the king and his wife, or the queen and her husband, whichever the way it goes. There's a queen there now, so it'd be the queen or husband. They have children. They might have multiple children, but the eldest male child is the heir apparent. Becomes what's known as the Prince of Wales. He's the king in waiting, if you will. And what kind of a life does he live? He actually lives a different life from the rest of his siblings. Everything. In his training. He's trained to be king. The rest of them are not. So they're specialized. They're withdrawn from so many things. And the high priest, was he in tune? Did he sympathize with other people's weaknesses and things? I don't know. Were there times when he looked out the window and saw people in their everyday lives walking around in Jerusalem or something? I don't know if they did that or not. I'm just saying, you know, for instance. And see all the humanity out there and everything that's going on, and perhaps think to himself, what is going on out there? He would have no idea. None. You know. Now, my mom's from England. She used to explain this British royalty things to me and so on when I was just a little guy. And Bonnie Prince Charlie was about my age, and I used to see pictures of him on TV, and Mom would just, oh. She'd get all excited about it. I really didn't. But I can remember looking at the pictures, you know, and I'd see that little boy on TV and everything, and I'd listen to what my mother had told me, and I thought, boy, I don't think he would know how to play ball. You know. And to me, that would just be the greatest tragedy of life, you know, when you're about 6 years old. And he didn't. You stop and think about this, you know. It said, we're all familiar with, just as an example, there was a king who decided to marry a commoner, Edward. Oh, you can't do that. So he abdicated
the throne. And it fell to his younger brother, George. George became king. And George had never been trained to be king. He was a grown man. And he had a family. And it was extremely difficult circumstances for him to be thrust into that. And it all happened in conjunction with World War II. You can imagine how difficult it would have been. And anyway, I think that we can understand this, and we can see how Jesus can sympathize with it. Doesn't that sound... I think that sounds so great that Jesus sympathizes with you and me. He's gone through these things. You know, He knows what it's like to be tired. And so many other things. That brings us to our next point. He's able to understand and sympathize with other sufferers. Hebrews chapter 2, verse 17. Therefore, he had to be made like his brethren that he might be a merciful and faithful high priest in things pertaining to God, to make propitiation for the sins of the people. You know, Jesus had intimate knowledge of the problems of man. In Hebrews chapter 5, verses 1 and 2, every high priest taken from among men is appointed for men and things pertaining to God, that he may offer both gifts and sacrifices. He can have compassion on those who are ignorant and going astray, since he himself is also beset by weakness. I think that they were limited, the high priest at the time, but that's not the case with Jesus. He wasn't limited with these things. And just think about the number of things that Jesus experienced, that Jesus suffered. And really, in a sense, they are things that are common things, but in his circumstance, they were enormous things to experience. You know, Jesus experienced the death of a close friend. And I'm not going to read the passages. John 11, verses 1 through 46. You know who that is? That's Lazarus. And there were people there that said, you know, he was a friend of his. Behold. And what did Jesus do when he... at the tomb of Lazarus. He wept. He knew what it was like to lose a close friend to death. And Jesus knew about betrayal. Judas, an apostle, a disciple, becomes an apostle. Who was it that selected him? Well, that would be Jesus. And he betrayed him. He knows about betrayal. Have you ever experienced betrayal? Do you know the feeling of that? And especially someone who's a friend, or seemingly a friend. It's just a terrible feeling. But then he also knows about a close friend denying him. That would have been Peter, wouldn't it? And he denied him strongly. And then we find out that Jesus knows all about physical abuse from enemies. I mean, they struck him, they spit on him, they mocked him, everything that you can think of. Things that we would not like ourselves, that they would upset us to no end, that kind of thing happened. He knows all about that. And then also, Jesus knows about injustice. I guess that's what you hear a lot today, isn't it? You know, all of the people that are crying victimology, I'm a victim of this, I'm a victim of that, everybody's a victim anymore. Okay. But are you a victim like the Lord was, or have you just invented your victimology? Pilate, the man who had the say, the man that the Jews went to execute Jesus, said, I find no fault in him. He should have been told, you're free to go. That didn't happen. No, despite being told that I find no fault in him, he still experienced injustice through the death on the cross. So once again, from Brother Willis, the disappointments and adversities of life, they were all known by Jesus. He can sympathize with our weaknesses. He knows what it's like. Is there anyone better qualified to comfort us than Jesus? Think about it. Is there anyone better qualified to serve as our example? We should be thankful that in the ultimate and finite wisdom of God, Jesus came to do so much for us. And I think it's all summed up. Take your songbooks, turn, song's been selected. I think it's all summed up in the passage that's found in 2 Corinthians chapter 8, verse 9, which has always been a favorite passage of mine in 2 Corinthians. It says, "For you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sakes he became poor, that you, through his poverty, might be rich." And that's not talking about being rich here on the face of this earth. No. Our treasure is in heaven. That's where Jesus' treasure was at. And he gave that up to come here and be poor, so that his being poor, we can become rich, not in the world's goods, but with that treasure that's in heaven. And that's something that's available to all, if all they're asked to do is to obey the gospel of Christ. We invite you tonight to do that. We're going to be singing a song here that brings that out. Jesus is indeed the loving shepherd, and he wants all to be saved. But once again, like we looked at tonight, that happens when a person is willing to obey his gospel. Are you willing? Will you come then while together we stand and sing?